Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, She Done It listeners, and welcome to something a little different. This is a crossover episode with another podcast that I'm making at the moment in connection with my new book, A Body Made of Glass, A History of Hypochondria. In that series, I'm hosting conversations that encompass the intersection of health anxiety with different aspects of medicine, scientific history, mental health, and more. And I thought that this one, with past She Done It guest Moira Redmond, might be of interest to you. We're talking today not about detective fiction, but about another major popular fiction trend of the interwar period, school stories. To be more specific, the Chalet School series written by Eleanor M. Brent Dyer. The first book, The School at the Chalet, was published in 1925, and 57 more books then followed until the last one, Prefects of the Chalet School, appeared in 1970. The school is originally based in Austria, but moves in the late 1930s in reaction to the rise of the Nazi Party, and then relocates variously to the Channel Islands, the UK, and then Switzerland. It is no exaggeration to say that I was, as a child, and still am to a large extent, obsessed with these books. And as you'll hear Moira and I discuss, the vision of health that they promote was very influential to me in forming my own early views on that subject. And then later, they had a role to play in shaping my hypochondria and health anxiety. I hope you find this interesting. Tell me about your first encounter with the Chalet School.
I was a huge fan of school stories, probably from about the age of 9 or 10 onwards, right through for a long time. I loved any school story and I read anything I could get my hands on. And I, including the Enid Blyton books that were very popular and some books that were quite old. But then eventually I came across a Chalet School book and I thought, oh, this is the business. I love this because this is schoolgirls in foreign countries. They were in Austria. That was very exciting. And I was hugely, I used to get them from the library. And I used to race to the library to change my library books on a Saturday. And I went with someone else and we would be saying, I wonder if there'll be any Chalet School books. And so I read them completely out of order, not with any kind of full realization that they date from 1925 through till 1969, something like that. I wasn't getting that, and I didn't know why they were in Austria one minute and they were Switzerland the next minute. I didn't really understand all that. I just loved reading the books. I loved everything about them.
That's incredible, isn't it? The fact that they were, because I had the same experience when I was a child, that they just didn't really seem of that context in the way that they do now when I read them, that the early ones feel very obviously pre-World War II. And then you can see how, you know, life for girls changes through the series and all of this. And just all of that completely went over my head when I was a child.
I was exactly the same. And what I can also remember is my mother saying to me, oh, Chalet School books, I used to read those. And I thought, what's she talking about? These are my books. You know, these are kind of, I don't know, I thought they were current, I think, and I didn't really believe her. And she said, yes, no, I had those when I was at school. That was a real shocker for me. And now, reading them now, you just see this incredible progress and changes and huge differences from beginning to end. But that was a completely missed.
Because they do start very recognisably in the 1920s, don't they? And everything from the way that girls' education is viewed right down to the kind of food they eat and so on is very of its period.
Yes, very much so, yes. And they say in a very matter-of-fact way about there are various Austrian girls in the school early on, and they just say, oh, well, they'll all be getting married when they're 18. That's what Austrian girls do. And there's a kind of implication that the English girls probably aren't going to get married quite so young. But it's a very, and people wearing traditional dress, their parents are in, Austrian traditional dress. And it's It's fascinating to read them now, but I wasn't getting that quite.
Yes, so the series starts with this English family, the Bettanys, grown-up brother and sister and younger sister, Joey. And their main driving force behind the whole thing actually is Joey's health, isn't it? That they've been told by a doctor that she can't really live in England because she's too delicate and the English winters will make her unwell, and that therefore they need to find somewhere overseas to base themselves. But they don't have the money to live the kind of perpetual life of invalids on the south of France or something. And so their solution is start a school, which again, as a child, I was like, well, of course. Now as an adult, I'm like, really? Was that your best option?
Indeed, yes, yes. And the school, it's incredibly casual when they start school, and they have a few friends and friends, oh, you can have my daughter as well. And then the kind of word gets out in the village. So on the first day, I mean, kind of people are just walking up the hill to the school, but they haven't registered or, you know, anything like that. It just turned up and they say, oh, great, look, there's some pupils for the school. And they'll all going to presumably pay the fees. But yes, it's quite remarkable, the idea that you just rent a shirt, and I presume they rented it initially, rent this building in this fairly remote part of Austria and start a school, and that'll do it. So, but yes, and Joey, who is throughout the books, is simultaneously incredibly strong and able to do all kinds of things. But when it suits the plot, she suddenly can become very, very fragile indeed, poor Joey.
And there's never any discussion of what's actually wrong with her, is there? It's never, you know, she has some childhood illness that's still affecting her, or that she has a disability, or there's never any specifics given of what her limitations are. And as you say, they definitely come and go as the books require. There's just a lot of Joey must wrap up warm. Joey mustn't get wet. Joey is delicate and needs to rest all the time. Joey has, you know, hollows under her eyes, all that sort of language.
She's looking very, very tired. But then Joey will go out and save somebody's life. They'll be out in an avalanche or at a tobogganing accident, and Joey will go and rescue them with enormous strength. But then that is going to take it out of her, and she will then have to go to bed for 3 weeks, and everybody will be worrying about her. There was that great thing that was in a lot of books at the time, which is that people have a fever, and the fever is going to come to a crisis, and either they will survive or they'll die. I have no idea if this is a real thing, but it's a great feature in books. And obviously great for plot purposes.
It's narratively amazing. Yeah, that happens, I feel, multiple times throughout the series.
Multiple times.
With Joey and with other girls, where there's one incident where Joey falls through the ice of the lake when she's snuck out with some friends to go skating after hours, and she falls through the ice and she gets obviously soaking wet, and that triggers a prolonged period of fever. And then, you know, and there's lots of, for a long time, nothing's really happening and she's not improving and she's not getting worse. And the doctor comes every day and shakes his head. And then it comes to a crisis. And the doctor's able to say, you know, if she makes it through the night, then she'll make it.
Yes, that is such a classic Shelley school scene, isn't it? And I have to remind myself in some ways, because it's easy to mock in the early ones, particularly all these dramas, but it was a different time. And we're kind of used to the idea now that we've got antibiotics, things can be cured a lot more easily. Whereas actually, genuinely, I mean, the adventures are obviously completely unrealistic, but illnesses probably were more worrying in those days. And I have to kind of remind myself of that before I mock too hard.
Yes.
They weren't just going to take a warm-up.
I think that's such a great point, because I do think that from the research that I've been able to do into, you know, what healthcare looked like for a lot of people in those times, pre-NHS, pre-antibiotics, pre-kind of organised healthcare, really, in a meaningful way for a lot of people, unless you had a lot of money, that it was just, you know, your older sister would fetch some castor oil from the bathroom and hope for the best, you know? And so that is what healthcare looks like. And you get that throughout. The school always has a matron. And for a long time, it's the same matron who's this very brusque but caring figure.
Matey.
And she, you know, if some girls get wet on a walk or are looking a bit peaky, she says to them, you know, make sure you come by my room before you go to bed tonight and I'll give you something. And by something, she just means like a dose of salts or senna or something.
Yeah. A tonic is a great thing. At one point, it's mentioned that she has some special calming tonic, which is going to help the girls get over these dramas that they're having. But, I mean, the amount of illness in these books is astonishing. Yeah. And as I say, I read an awful lot of school stories, so I know that by comparison, these are the ones that have the illness in them. In the other books, occasionally somebody gets sick. They have to have a health certificate when they arrive. There is a matron. But this woman is obsessed with health, don't you think?
She really is. It's remarkable. Yes, because I similarly read a ton of other, you know, Angela Brazil and the Mellings books and Enid Blyton and all of these other ones. And yes, I'd say illness occurs in those about as often as you might expect in sort of general population type thing. Charlotte School is obsessed with it. Initially, through Joey's character, and then in a few books in, she gets this younger adopted sister, the Robin, they call her, who, I mean, that is very vague but concerning. You know, she's supposed to have this mother who I think we're led to believe died of probably tuberculosis, but I think it's just described as decline or consumption. And the concern is that the Robin has inherited it and that she is a very delicate little girl and needs to be taken care of and all this kind of thing. And so through these characters and various other ones with the same tendencies, it's just on every page, this concern.
Every page. When I was rereading these books for the purpose of this podcast, and I said to you, I have rarely enjoyed the research for something I'm doing as much as I enjoyed this. But I started making notes of illness in, and every book has illness every few pages. It's quite astonishing. The notes are just, stand by the file is huge. And people have parents dying. There are people dying of peritonitis. There's an outbreak of measles. There's dangerous emergency operations. And there's German measles. And then there's a whole other thing, which is that school, both in its early iteration and later on, is attached to a sanatorium, which is where the TB patients are, which is quite an interesting extra sign on this, isn't it?
It also feels like has to have been a personal interest or experience of the writer Eleanor Brent Dyer, because it's just so odd and unusual. Because what happens is that the Joey's older sister Madge Bettany, who set up the school and is its first headmistress, they in a bizarre twist of fate, in a kind of train accident, they meet this man, Dr. Jem, who Madge then later marries. And Jem is out in Austria to set up a tuberculosis sanatorium, because that's what he's specializing in. And so they kind of run their two businesses connected in a way. The school gets a lot of pupils from the daughters and younger sisters of people who are coming out to Austria to go to Jem's sanatorium, and then vice versa. People who've come to the school will then be like, oh, there's a sanatorium here. My mother could come out and stay there while I'm at school. And so the two kind of exist linked like this. And there's always this sense that the sanatorium doctors have the care of the girl's health. And yeah, the two things are merged in a way that, I mean, did such a school ever exist? Surely not.
It is very, very strange. But then sanatoriums, they were a big deal at the time, I guess. I don't think they normally had a school attached to them, but it was a huge part of life. I read quite a lot about this a couple of years ago. There's a lot of literature based on sanatoriums from the Magic Mountain onwards. And it was a big part of people's lives, because until the late 40s, nobody knew how to cope with it. And the sanatoriums were the best bet. But even so, most people were probably going to die. It's called in one of the books here, the White Plague, horrible thing. And throughout the books, in a very matter-of-fact way, one of the things that's interesting about the books is that they often deal with what the teachers' conversations, you're privy to the teachers' conversations in the staff room, which isn't particularly common in school stories. But the teachers will be talking in a very matter-of-fact way about so-and-so's mother who's dead and so-and-so's father who's dying and someone else who's at the sanatorium, but they haven't really got great hopes for them at the moment. They're very kind of upfront about death and dying and very serious illness. And it's never underplayed, the whole TB consumption thing. The school also has the girls fundraise so that there can be free beds in the sanatorium for poor people. And so they have fundraising sales and such like, particularly in the later books. They have the Son of Fate, I think, and a Christmas sale of work. So they're all busy trying to help people.
Yes, it's fascinating. The two things are completely intertwined. And yes, you say it's very, death is very present in the books, far more than, again, you would expect for the genre that the series very firmly belongs to. That, yes, you get characters who have are losing parents, are losing siblings, who are losing people very close to them because of this illness that is so documented in the books. And, you know, I think the books are relatively sensitive about it, but they do come back to school just a few days after this will happen. You know, they'll get a quiet weekend with Dr. Jem and Miss Bettany, and then they'll be sent back to school and expected to get back on with life. Because, as you say, sadly, a common occurrence, something that a lot of people would be familiar with, is just this idea that, you know, my mother's very sick and there is nothing that they can do.
In History's Secret Heroes, Helena Bonham Carter shines a light on extraordinary stories from World War II. This is a series that tells the tales from the Second World War that are unjustly less well known than the oft-repeated histories of that time. Personally, I tend to default to the position that military history, or the history of wars as it is usually told, is just not for me. But diving into this series has shown me that I can be wrong about that, and that maybe I just haven't been experiencing the right sort of history. The brand new second series of History's Secret Heroes is out now, and it's absolutely full of brilliant episodes that had me gripped from start to finish. In it, we learn how a single woman, Christine Granville, skied into occupied Poland and gathered essential intelligence for the Allies, which changed the course of the war. We also look at how Raymond Goureme used his circus skills to break in and out of a Nazi internment camp to sneak in food and supplies for his family, and how a young Filipino woman named Josefina Guerrero took advantage of her health condition to join the resistance and become one of the most consequential spies of World War II. I'm especially drawn to stories about code breaking, as I love puzzles, and to me it often feels like the real life counterpart to solving a mystery. I loved the episode called The Unbreakable Navajo Code, about a group of Native American soldiers who devised a code for the Allies' use. And I also really enjoyed the one about Emily Anderson, an Irish cryptanalyst who worked both at Bletchley Park in the UK and then in Cairo to decrypt vital intelligence. Helena Bonham Carter voices all of these episodes in a way that makes you feel like they're just being whispered directly into your ear by someone who really knows how to tell a dramatic tale to full effect. There are experts interviewed, but also friends, family members, and witnesses, so each story feels personal and intimate, as well as historically significant. Episodes will be released on Mondays, wherever you get your podcasts. But if you're in the UK, you can listen to the full series now, first on BBC Sounds.
Yes, and it's almost more like in Victorian novel, this happens. You know, there's a lot of second marriages and so on because people are dying all the time. It's a lot of childbirth, which you don't get in this. But it is a very sort of matter of fact attitude to it, and I think it possibly continues longer, well into the books in the 50s and 60s, in a way that's not quite as convincing. There's a moment in one of the books where a girl becomes very ill at school, and they send a telegram to her father to say, she's very ill, you must come at once. And he's talking to the housekeeper and saying, oh my goodness, maybe she's going to die. And the housekeeper says, oh no, because if she was dead, if the worst had happened, They'd have written. They wouldn't have telegrammed. Sent you a telegram. This suggests that there is some hope. And I just kept reading this sentence and thinking, this is extraordinary. I don't know whether it's true.
I think I understand the logic of it, though, right? The idea that if she died, it's not so urgent. We don't need to spend the money on a telegram.
There's no hurry.
There's no hurry because you don't have to get here right now. But yes, that is extraordinary as the mundanity of something so serious.
Yes, yeah, just a different world at a different time, I think. She's also, there's Elder M. Brett Dyer, I don't think she ever married, and she didn't have children. And she's very, very keen on children behaving themselves in the way that it can be that people who don't have children think my children would never be allowed to behave like that. But actually, there's a mention several times throughout the series where they say English and American children don't obey their parents, and therefore they're more likely to get ill, which is a very niche thing here, that the Austrian and the German children do what their parents tell them, and that is going to keep them safer, whereas these English and American children are very disobedient, and they don't look after themselves properly because of this. And that's an interesting aspect.
It's a fascinating sort of subtle distinction. And as well, I think there, I remember a few times when the school goes on these trips, they go on these half-term trips to different locations. They go to the Oberammergau passion play in one of the stories and so on. I think it comes up then as well, doesn't it, that the English and American girls expect a degree of independence that the sort of Central European children just aren't accustomed to. They expect to be allowed to walk around on their own and go where they want and eat when they want. And that's, you know, especially when they're being supervised by teachers from the other tradition. They're like, no, of course not. Why would we allow you to do that? You will be back here when we say you will, and you will always have an older girl with you. And I think, and that passion play story I reference is one that has a kind of mountaineering accident in it, which actually stems from exactly this, from one of, I think she's one of the American girls, sort of being disobedient and wanting to go and see something that she's been told there isn't, she's not allowed to go and do.
Yes, absolute classic. Every book almost has some similar story to that. Melanie is caught out in the storm, her own fault. This is my notes from my book. And then too poorly for anything but bed for a day or two. And this is classic. Some of them close to dying. Some of them just need a few days in bed. Although the other thing that's important to note is that milky coffee and rolls and delicious cakes have almost magical powers for recovery. That will make these girls feel better.
Yes. So the main things that I feel like when I was a child reading these books that I imbibed from it, one was an obsession with Austria, which continues to this day. Culture, food, music, books, all of it. Then it was definitely the lifestyle of the girls in those early books, the kind of getting good sleep and the regular meals and lots of fresh air and so on. I really looked up to that as a way to be when I was a child. And yes, was always asking, like, could I have coffee and things when my parents are like, no, you're a child. You're not allowed coffee. quote, which is obviously, you know, different standard in the 90s. But yes, I feel like there was a regime to life at the Chalet School that was so attractive to me. I found it so interesting.
Absolutely. And the fact that they spoke different languages on different days. There was... They all had to be trilingual. They were fined if they used the wrong words, and they weren't allowed to use slang. And they were fined if they used slang. And I was making notes on this as well. I got terribly interested in the slang as to what constituted slang and what didn't. You weren't allowed to call something marvelous. Why not? I don't know. And they talked in this very strange schoolgirlish way, and then one of them would suddenly say, "Oh, that's slang. You'll have to pay a fine for that." It's quite extraordinary. And I would have hated every minute of it if I'd been there. But that's not what I thought. Where 10-year-old me thought, oh, I'd love it to be there. I remember, you know, going tobogganing and skating and wearing. In later years, they had this wonderful uniform, which was gentian blue with touches of crimson. Do you remember that? And they actually had ski suits were part of it. And then they put a shawl over the top. And I love this. I once mentioned Chalet School on Twitter, and all my women writer friends were just jumping in and saying, you know, I don't remember what I had for my dinner yesterday, but I can tell you what the Chalet School uniform is. And I can tell you which day they spoke French and which day they spoke German. I thought, yeah, that was true for all of us, I think.
Because that's the thing, isn't it? That whilst for people who have never heard of these books, either just because they didn't cross your path or because you're a man or something, it might sound like what we're talking about is incredibly niche. Actually, if you sort of scratch the surface of almost any kind of bookish inclined woman over the age of about 25, and probably some under as well, you will find that they carry the flame for these books.
Absolutely, absolutely. They were, and reading them again recently, it was just, I mean, it all came back to me, all this realization and this realization of how much I'd love them. And yes, they're nonsensical, and yes, you can laugh at them. And I wouldn't also agree with a number of things that she says or her beliefs. But on the other hand, there was a good-heartedness to them. And what there was this internationalism, this view you must never criticize or mock somebody who's different from you. And even at one point, you know, there are, in the early days, there are gypsies. And again, it's not quite, I mean, there's also othering and then it's together, but, you know, you're not allowed to criticize the gypsies. They have their own way of life and that's their business. And you think, well, good for you, actually. And not everybody would have been saying that at that time.
Yes. I would also say the other thing about Eleanor Brent Dyer, which is very interesting, is that she was on the right side of history about the Second World War before a lot of other people were, because she was publishing books in real time through the late 30s and 40s. Very unusually, she kept going. And so, you know, there's basically a pogrom in one of the sort of pre-wartime books where the Austrian village where the school is, there's this mob, they're attacking a local Jewish shopkeeper, and the girls get in between the shopkeeper and the mob, and a couple of them are actually injured in trying to protect him and trying to help him escape. They then attract the attention of the Nazi party, and the whole school has to sort of make this daring escape across the mountains. Well, not the whole school, some of the pupils have to make this daring escape across the mountains because they've gone against what is now the kind of ruling authoritarian regime. And she was doing that in like 1938, before anybody knew what was going to happen or how it was going to turn out.
Yeah, that, I mean, I think that is absolutely extraordinary. And to be honest, it's quite different. There's a book called The Shallow School in Exile, which I think was published in 1940, but it's dealing with events in 1938 and 1939. And I think it's astonishing. It is just extraordinary because it's exactly as you describe. There are no punches pulled. I know when they escape, they meet up with somebody later and you think they'll say, oh, yes, yes, and everything's all right. But it's not. The other people involved in this issue died. They said, oh, no, the shopkeeper died, his wife's dying, and the priest is going to die, which is just as well because he'd be shot if he wasn't. There's no messing around. I mean, it's quite an extraordinary book, The Shallow School in Exile, and she can't have known what was going to happen in the war, but she is very firm about people are disappearing into concentration camps. There's a mention of somebody in that says, well, we are actually hoping he's dead because otherwise he's in a camp having this terrible time. I mean, it's absolutely extraordinary. And I think very, very few authors were doing that at that time. And as you say, she is on the right side of history and very, very charming. I mean, there's a point where they form a Shallow School Peace League. And I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous in one way, and it leads them into awful danger. But you can't read about it without being affected by it, by being moved, by saying we must distinguish between wicked Nazis and ordinary Germans and Austrians who've had their country taken away from them. And we believe in peace, and we will not believe any lies spoken about what's happening. We will work for peace, and we will be the Chalet Girls. And it's incredibly touching. And I think very brave and clever. And I think very few people writing about, as you say, in real time could stand by what they said. But I thought she must have been very proud of that, I think.
Yes, I think it's fascinating because when you look at some of the sort of literature of the late 30s, there's kind of the whiff of appeasement about some of it. Like, you know, we can see that bad things are happening to Jewish people and other people over there, but, you know, everything's fine here and the greater good and blah, blah, blah. And she was like, no, the attack on one shopkeeper is bad enough. That for me condemns the entire thing, which is, yeah, as you say, she was right, but it wouldn't have been clear how right she was at the time when she was writing it. But what, just to sort of zoom out and think about the impact that that has on the larger series, what that means is that the Shallow School leaves Austria, which has been this sort of rest cure paradise for the school and the sanatorium for over a decade. It leaves. They initially go to Guernsey in the Channel Islands. Then the Nazis invade there too. And they come to England, or they come to the English-Welsh border for a while.
It's on the border, I think.
Then they're on an island for a bit, which is, I think, meant to be Anglesey or something like it.
It's a bit weird. Nobody quite knows what the island is, but it's Welsh.
It's a Welsh island somewhere. And then this very peculiar thing happens, which took me a long time to get my head around, is that they basically split the school and some of it goes to Switzerland and kind of resumes Alpine Chalet school life. There is supposedly still this kind of English branch, which is just then never really mentioned again after a few books. No discussion. But interestingly, when that's being set up, there is some angst among the girls about, you know, my mother won't let me be sent away to Europe as much as I want to go. You know, I'm not going to be allowed, or we can't afford it, or so and so forth. But they go to Switzerland. They don't go back to Austria because, again, I think she just felt that the political situation there was just not something she wanted to engage with or endorse. And so the Alpine Chalet School resumes its existence in Switzerland. And I think you've looked into those later books more recently than I have. Can you give us a little overview of what What remains of the health regime of the early chalet school by the time they get to Switzerland?
Well, rest assured, there is just as much illness in the later books as there is in the earlier ones. There is no kind of, you know, coming down just because we've got antibiotics now. There's an absolute classic, which is called Trials for the Chalet School. This is 1959. And the opening lines of this book is, "Remember, this is sickness term," Miss Wilson said forebodingly. "We get epidemics in the Easter term. They've got a new girl who's, the new girl is deformed. Her mind is warped. She's badly stooped with a crooked shoulder. I thought we decided after Iselt Pertwee never to take a new girl over 50, but they've taken this girl and she's going to cause endless trouble. She doesn't want to wear her big shawl when you go out in the snow, so she's going to get cold. Although not as bad, there's another one who won't say that she's allergic to wool. So she wears a cotton vest. And as a result of that, she gets cold and is ill. But then she puts on, I think they make her wear a woolen vest, and then she gets a rash. So they think there's measles. So there's tremendous health issues with this because she wears a cotton vest rather than a woolen vest. This girl falls headlong into the icy snow, striking her head and stunning herself. There's a scarlet fever, a raging epidemic. Well, we'll turn the sound into an isolation hospital, says matron. What did we do last year when we had the flu epidemic, they say. Mistresses began to fall before the foe. And so on and on and on we go. And then there's an avalanche after that. But they are bruised and cut from flying debris. And on the floor lay Naomi, still white and senseless, to all appearance dead. But then she's put in a motorcycle sidecar to get her to the hospital, and the motorcycle crashes. So she gets an extra problem here. Three ribs badly broken. But if she doesn't die, she'll be much better than she was before. She may need blood transfusions. May I be the one to give it to her? But she recovers, of course, because on the whole, they do. There's a lot of illness making people bad-tempered. It's a good plot trigger. There's a lot of dentists. There was a major feature in the Chalet School, is trips to the dentist, the nearest town. No medical moment is left untouched here. There's a child who's burning hot, feverish, shivering. In one of the books I studied, in my notes, I say, it seemed relaxed. 50 pages in, very little illness. But then chapter 6 is called An Unexpected Event, and it's an outbreak of smallpox.
Oh, my goodness.
Which actually doesn't, it's a local family. The epidemic is avoided by the school, but one girl reacts badly to the vaccination in true Chalet School style and is very ill. And then they're attacked by a swarm of insects, and they all require calming medicine from matron.
Of course.
And then the sleepwalking. And then someone says, health comes before even lessons every time in the school. The school is amazing. No wonder I wanted to go there.
Oh, they're always having such excitements, even if the excitements are probably quite horrible to live through, even.
After Joey has now grown up and married to another doctor from the sanatorium, as you know, and she goes on to have 11 children.
So many children.
Triplets and twins, but, you know, still 11 children. But then after one of them, she becomes quite ill. She has a displaced organ, so needs an operation. I thought, is she running out of ideas, or is this just a really great idea, having a displaced? Just envision that something's in the wrong place and they're going to get in there and push it back.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Tremendous stuff. Absolutely tremendous.
That's my memory of the later books, is certainly that everything just becomes, possibly because of the way that, you know, children's literature was going, or maybe because she's just got very much into her groove, everything becomes bigger and more dramatic. So in the first sort of pre-war set, we don't really get avalanches and motorcar sidecars. We get someone twists their ankle on the mountain pass and the shepherd carries them down to the valley. And then it's that, but times 11 sort of thing.
Absolutely. And I think in the earlier books, there will be one or maybe two big events in the thing. And in the later ones, I mean, it's just one chapter after another. And they're caught in the storm overnight. So they have to spend the night in the barn. And then on the way back down from the barn, somebody's going to fall. And somebody else is going to be very weak and carried. It's just endless. And just when you think people are getting better, something will happen. She had a vivid imagination.
She really did. Something I remember coming up in later books that is also kind of there a little bit in the earlier ones, but it's definitely more, is this idea of disability as something that can be cured and recovered from. So you have, you know, a girl will have a bad fall on the mountain and she'll hurt her back. But rather than it just being, you know, well, she's just got physical limitations now and she will exist with them and so on. It's always, you know, she has to lie down for 6 months and then she'll be okay again. And this is kind of character forming in a way that, I don't know, I do remember from other books, I was very into the What Katie Did books, the American ones, which are from an earlier period.
Me too.
But the first, you know, What Katie Did is kind of all about that. You know, Katie hurts herself being irresponsible and playing on a swing when she's not supposed to. Hurts her back, then has to endure, is it years? A couple of years of serious pain and limitation, but then she's allowed to recover at the end. And I remember being so struck when Jacqueline Wilson was invited to do a retelling of that book not very long ago, a few years ago. And in her version, Katie doesn't get better magically. Katie is always going to be a wheelchair user, but we're more encouraged to see that that's a good life. Like, that is good. Yeah.
Couldn't agree with you more. That's exactly what I felt. I was so interested to see where you were going with that. And that's exactly what I thought. I was so surprised, actually. I think I did expect Jacqueline Wilson's heroine to follow the same trajectory as our Katie, but no, she doesn't. And it felt like quite a realistic story, the Jacqueline Wilson one. And she does have her becoming more, she has a stepmother who she doesn't like. And it helps that they try with that, but it doesn't underplay the difficulties of what would have happened, but it's a positive view of Katie's future. But yeah, Shelley School is definitely old school in that. It's definitely on the Katie, What Katie Did, rather than Jacqueline Wilson.
And it also seems to happen to, like, Mary Lou is a character who becomes quite important in the middle
right
to late
Mary
period.
Lou. Everybody, yeah.
And she has a period like that, doesn't she? She has a fall.
She
and then a recovery.
Is something wrong with her spine? Yeah. She'll never walk again, they think, at one point. She has a tobogganing accident.
That's right.
Accident,
yes.
Because of someone else's bad behavior. I think she goes out to rescue somebody else. And they're really, yeah, she's unconscious for 5 days. But eventually they will say, quite often there's an important operation. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if there is in this case. But which, fortunately, we have all these wonderful doctors nearby who may be experts in TB, but they're also going to be able to perform orthopedics. And then, yes, it'll take a while before she gets better. But if she rests now, she'll be all right. And they all learn valuable life lessons from this.
I was going to say, is that all of this health stuff, whether it's an illness or an epidemic or an accident and a convalescence, it's always so connected into the morality of the books, that the virtues that the books prize, like patience and forbearance and kindness, if you demonstrate those through your recovery, as opposed to being stubborn and rude and difficult and impatient, then you will achieve the recovery you deserve. So, because we should say as well that Christian faith is quite a big thing in these books as well, that there's a lot of, I think mostly in a fairly benign and friendly way, but it is a presence for sure. And I think that there is something of that in the sort of more spiritual, moral dimension to the illness stuff, that it's very much, you know, if you live a good life on earth, you will be rewarded hereafter, is the feeling I get.
Yeah, there is quite a strong, but she does try to be somewhat ecumenical. I mean, you're not hearing very much about, there's not very many Muslim girls in school or even Jewish girls, and you'd think there would be. But she does try to say, okay, these are the Catholics and these are not the Catholics. These are the Church of England, and that's fine. We all do our own thing, and that's fine. The other thing about having one of these terrible illnesses is that there's always an older girl who can come and visit you in the sand and say, well, this happened to me 2 years ago, and now I'm fine. It's going to be Mary Luke. And I wouldn't say, I had this terrible accident, but look at me. So, you know, it's very cheering that there's always been somebody who this has already happened to them. Going right back to the beginning of the school, really.
Yes, it is now that I look at these books again, having spent all these years reading and researching about health, it does astonish me the extent to which I was just gobbling down all of these ideas when what my parents and other adults who saw me reading these books thought I was reading were kind of jolly hockey sticks japes, which is really a very minor part of the Jalet School by comparison.
Yes, indeed. Yes. And I'm interested that I think you were aware of it when you were reading them as a young person. And I don't think I was. I mean, I think I was just, I just thought, oh, this is a school story. And I didn't kind of think of it till afterwards, how much illness there was. And I was noticing again when I was reading them that they built a new part of one of the school at one point. And then there's this incredibly long description of the new health facilities. And I mean, you didn't get that in Mallory Towers, did you? Nobody was telling you about them, how big the sanatorium was. And there's a smaller room for suspects, a dainty little chamber intended for a nurse. Then there's a bathroom and a kitchen, open front door, little lawn where convalescents could take an air. And you're thinking, this is utterly bizarre. This is you know, the description, detailed description of the sick room is strange.
Yes, I think the thing that really animated me when I was reading them as a child was the constant classification of girls as either delicate or strong. And I think I was very preoccupied by, like, which one am I? Which one would I be? What would they decide? Am I a girl who has to drink a lot of milk and go to bed early? Or am I a girl who is allowed to climb mountains? Because I can't be both.
No, you can't. No. And it's definitely better to be healthy, I think. But it's more interesting to be sick.
I guess.
Focus of a lot of attention.
That's kind of the message, is that if you're sick, you might have to go through some unpleasant things, but you'll also probably get to be the star of a book.
You'd be blanched and peaky, and you feel that matron and also the teaching staff are meant to be watching the girls like hawks, to see signs of being blanched or peaky, and that you need to be looked at. And there, at some point, there is criticism of somebody because they didn't notice that a particular girl was obviously sinking in some way. It was all very odd.
And it's vague and unspecific, and it's just not clear what these teachers are supposed to be noticing. But they also, at one point, they have the Chalet School Annex, which is like a special little outpost of the school right next door to the sanatorium for those girls who are especially being watched. So the Robin ends up going there, for instance, because she needs special watching. It, as I say, never clear what the proximity to the sanatorium is supposed to achieve or what the teachers there are able to do that the ones down in the valley are not, and so on. But it's just very clear that there are sort of different grades you can move through in terms of levels of delicacy. And that was the thing that I was obsessed with when I was reading these books.
It's also because they go on for so long. In fact, there is the teachers, they get married, they have children, their children come to the Chalet School, they come back to teach at the Chalet School. There is that sort of long continuation. But whenever they're describing whatever's happened to somebody else, they're saying, oh, so-and-so is coming to the school because, and in another book, it might be that their father's going to work, whatever, but it's always illness, or it's always, there's one of them, the child comes because the mother that was captured by the Mau Mau in Kenya and was ill-treated and became ill and now has a bad heart. And that would be an absolutely typical backstory. It's completely unnecessary. You don't need that as a reason for X to come to the Chalet School. But that will be why. It won't be just, oh, her parents thought it would be nice for her to come to school. Oh, no. It's that, and that the governess has had to go home because her stepmother's died and she has to go and look after her brothers and sisters. These sort of weird backstories, which always, always involve illness and probably death as well.
Yes, you're right.
I mean, I can't remember another school story, anybody ever dying, but the outside characters are always dying in the Chalet School.
I have a few memories of sort of isolated stories where someone gets a letter saying that their mother's not very well and they're a bit down for a few days, but then it's often never really mentioned again. And it only exists to explain why that girl is going to be a bit taciturn for a while. It's not part of a larger theme, you know.
Yes, but Matron can keep an eye on her, so that's all right.
So, yes, it is extraordinary, I think, to re-examine these books with a kind of more complete understanding of health and the world as it was when they were written. And as it was when, you know, the various points in time when people have been reading them, because these books are fantastically popular. They've, I think, remained in print basically the entire time. There've been sort of successive different editions. I have now collected all of the Armada editions. I have them all in matching ones. And there's a little publishing company called Girls Gone By that reissues ones that are difficult to get hold of. And they also, people write fill-in ones for terms that aren't covered by the original series. And they produce little companion books where you can endlessly speculate about, you know, because she has these, as you say, she has these very sort of long family trees almost that run through it, siblings and children. And sometimes, like all writers who've written 58 books or however many it is, she gets them wrong and she uses the same character. And anyway, so there's now a kind of critical literature about this and so on. So it is a real phenomenon, which is now nearly 100 years in the making. So thank you very much, Moira, for going on this journey with me. I enjoyed it very much.
It was a genuine pleasure. And I would just like to say one more thing, which is that there was something called the Shelley School Club. Mm. And I was a member of the Shelley School Club right at the end. It ended when she died in 1969. I was one of the last members, I think. You're too young.
I've seen it.
I was actually a member.
It was in the back of some of the books. And I remember seeing that. And I think I did try and write to the address it gave. And obviously it didn't exist anymore. But no, I remember that. I was very interested in it.
It was a key thing to be involved in that. It's still such a big part of my life. I loved it.
Yeah.
And as I say, I would have hated it in real life, but I quite convinced myself that I would have been a lovely pupil at the Shelley School.
A model pupil, yes. Thanks for listening. My book about hypochondria, A Body Made of Glass, is available to order everywhere books are sold, including as an audiobook read by me. Links to where to find it are in the description for this episode. And if you'd like to hear more of Moira, I'm linking to several of the She Done It episodes she has appeared on in the description, and you can also find a link there to her excellent blog, Clothes in Books. Thank you very much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed this and would like to hear more on this subject, please do follow or subscribe to the A Body Made of Glass series in your podcast app so you don't miss the next conversation coming out. There's a link to help you do that in the description too. This podcast is produced and hosted by Caroline Crampton, with production assistance from Leandra Griffith and editing by Ewan McAleese.